From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Trading stopped on Wall Street for 15 minutes this morning in reaction to markets falling 7% in the U.S. at the open. Coronavirus fears and a steep drop in oil prices were behind that. And in the U.S., at least 566 cases of COVID-19 are now confirmed. That is more than double the number from last Friday. But President Trump has continued to downplay the severity of the virus. Let's bring in NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. Ayesha, let's start with one of the things a lot of people have been focusing on when it comes to the administration's response, and that is testing, the availability of tests. The president said while he was touring the CDC headquarters in Atlanta that anyone who wanted a test could get a test. Listen.
Importantly, anybody right now and yesterday, anybody that needs a test gets a test. They're there. They have the tests. And the tests are beautiful.
Well, speaking to Fox News this morning, Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar talked about the test kits this way.
Let me really be really clear about one point. There has never been a time since the CDC developed the lab test that any public health official in the United States who needed to get somebody tested for the novel coronavirus has been unable to get that person tested through the CDC's test in Atlanta.
Okay. We're hearing different things from different places, but what is the situation with the test kits at this point, as far as you know?
So this weekend, Azar and other federal officials said that 2.1 million tests would be shipped by early this week. And that would give the U.S. the capacity to test around 850,000 patients. But Azar also said that doctors would have to approve patients getting tests. So you couldn't just get a test because you wanted one. But even if your doctor says that you can get a test, that doesn't necessarily mean that that person will quickly get tested. And there have been reports that people say their health officials did want them to get tested and they haven't been tested. And part of that is because even though these tests are being shipped out, some of them are being prioritized to go to the places with the most cases. And then also there's this issue of just having more labs that are able to do these tests. The administration says that as more commercial labs like Quest Diagnostics and LabCorp roll out coronavirus tests, that could make the test more widely available. That also brings up issues around cost, obviously, if you have private companies, private labs doing it. Mm-hmm. Medicaid and Medicare will cover the cost of the screening, but private health insurance plans don't have to cover the screenings for free. And if you don't have health insurance, that's also a question. So, I mean, there are a lot of factors at play here.
The coronavirus seems to be striking close to home in Washington. There was word that Senator Ted Cruz and another member of Congress would self-quarantine after interacting with someone who was later sickened by COVID-19 at a conservative conference. The president, the vice president, and other White House officials were also at that conference. What's been the reaction to that, Ayesha?
Well, so White House Press Secretary Stephanie Grisham says there's no indication that Trump or Vice President Pence met with or were, quote, in close proximity to this person. They said that the president's doctor and Secret Service are working to keep the first family healthy and, you know, everyone that works in the White House complex. That said, I mean, just today, there were pictures of Trump landing for an event in Orlando. As he's getting off the plane, he's shaking hands. He went to the crowd that was there, was shaking all of their hands. He said last week that he's not going to stop doing that. He's not going to stop shaking hands and greeting people. Now, the Vice President Pence, he seems to actually be leaning towards the elbow bump, as has been recommended by some health officials. But right now, Trump's not doing that. So, I mean, depending on how things proceed with this virus, the way that Trump is handling or modeling how to handle this may get more scrutiny.
You know, the elbow bump, even I think maybe in a couple of weeks, that will even be too much. In Italy, they're already saying that anybody at a restaurant has to sit, I think, a meter away from the next person over. So we'll see what happens. What about the stock market, Ayesha? It's obviously not been doing well now for the last month or so. A big plummet today. It's fallen almost 20% in the last month. The president always talks about how great the stock market's doing. How's the White House reacting?
So right now, they haven't said much about this. I mean, we may hear more from him later today. But President Trump did reference falling oil prices. And what he said was that's good for consumers. The rub with that is that oil prices being low can be a sign of economic troubles. Generally, when the economy is doing well, oil demand is up and growing because industry needs fuel and people are out driving and going to work and things like that. But today, the International Energy Agency said that they're estimating that demand for oil will actually go down in 2020. That would be the first time that's happened since 2009. And obviously, 2009, the global economy was in really bad shape. Mm-hmm. So the president, you know, right now, the White House isn't saying anything about what they may do to address this, whether they will try some stimulus or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will stay tuned. That is NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, in Italy, as Jeremy mentioned, millions of people are on lockdown because of the virus. Today, Pope Francis celebrated Mass by himself in the Vatican and offered up prayers for those infected and those caring for them. Italy has more than 7,000 cases of COVID-19. That's the highest number outside of Asia. And the BBC's Bethany Bell joins us from Bologna. And Bethany, you're there in northern Italy where people are supposed to be under lockdown. What exactly does that mean?
Well, Bologna is just outside this quarantine zone, which is having an impact on the region of Lombardy, which has Italy's financial capital, Milan, and then 14 other provinces, which include places like Venice. Mm-hmm. And in these areas, people have been asked not to leave or enter these areas unless they have very pressing, essential work reasons to do so, or unless there are family emergencies. So this is really very, very tough, stringent restrictions on people's movements. And if they are inside those areas as well, they've been told to stay at home as much as possible to avoid meeting people in an attempt to try and stop the spread of the coronavirus. And yeah, when it's not quite clear yet exactly how much the government is doing to police these measures, but certainly we're told that at airports and at train stations, if people need to use the planes and trains that are still running to move in and out, they will be asked what their reasons are and they will have to justify the reasons. And if they're found that they're breaking these measures, they can face fines or even a prison sentence.
Oh, wow. I mean, this area, we're talking about 16 million people. It must be hurting tourism, which is a very important part of the Italian economy.
It's hugely hurting tourism. It's hurting tourism in the north, in the regions that are under quarantine, but it's also hitting tourism in places like Rome, which is not part of the quarantine zone because people are frightened to come here. Airlines have been cancelling their flights, partly because of lack of demand. And it's interesting that while many Italians say it's important that we do everything we can to stop the spread of this disease, some Italians are pushing back. And the governor of the province of Veneto, where Venice is, says that he strongly protests the fact that Venice has been put under these restrictions. And he wants the provinces of Venice, Padua and Treviso to be freed from these restrictions. So far, though, the government is saying this is a national emergency and people have to comply.
So it sounds very chaotic. I mean, are people confident in the government's response?
Very much depends on who you speak to. When this decree was announced, it was announced in the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning local time. And the details of what exactly the lockdown meant only sort of started coming out over the last day or so, and we're still sort of waiting to see what the full impact will be. The government has promised to massively increase spending to try and help people with this, what they call a massive financial shock therapy. But people's businesses are really suffering here. I mean, I'm in Bologna, and people have been telling me, you know, we're not in the isolation zone, but it's almost as if we are, because we're suffering in the same way. The tourists are just not here. it's a very complicated situation.
Yeah. I want to ask you about the healthcare system. So the death toll in Italy jumped significantly by 133 in just one day. I mentioned that there are more than 7,000 people infected. Can Italy's healthcare system actually handle this?
The average age of people who have died is 81. Italy has one of the world's oldest populations, and many of the people who have the disease here in Italy have had quite mild cases. But for those older people, many of them are needing intensive care, and that's where the strain is showing in Italy's health system. Here in the north, we've seen footage of hospitals where people are being treated in wards, hospital corridors, because the intensive care units are just being overwhelmed. And the fear is here that if this disease spreads significantly beyond northern Italy, that could have a huge impact on the health system in the south, which is not as developed as it is up here.
That's the BBC's Bethany Bell in Bologna. Bethany, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Anoush Zomorodi, and I am the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour. I am so excited because we are working on a bunch of new, amazing episodes. We're exploring big ideas about reinvention, making amends, and the psychological effects of climate change. Our first show drops March 13th. Please join me.
A few months ago, when we were in the thick of the impeachment hearings, a friend of mine sent a video to me through Instagram. It was a man wearing a t-shirt and jeans in his bedroom, holding a microphone and standing in front of a keyboard, singing his heart out. We gotta learn to love each other. We gotta learn to love each other. This man brought me, and obviously based on the number of likes, thousands of others, a moment of sheer joy. We were watching someone unabashedly reveling in the joy of creating music. His name is Mark Rubier, and he's an electronic musician and YouTuber originally from Dallas, Texas, who has amassed hundreds of thousands of fans through his many living room concerts. And Mark Rubier joins me now here at NPR West. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you, Tanya. It's great to be here.
So for those who can't see, you've got a whole setup here. You brought your keyboard. We're going to jam, right?
Oh, hell yeah.
This is NPR, okay? So let that be the most that
heck,
you curse.
Heck yes. National public yes.
So for those who don't know, you went from recording these videos in your bedroom and living room to becoming this viral sensation. What was that like for you?
It's very bizarre. It's very bizarre. I mean, this was something that I was doing while I was working a job at a call center, you know, entertaining myself, really hoping for maybe something in the distant future, but, you know, very dim lights on that. Eventually, I lost that job and I started playing local gigs in Dallas, where I'm originally from.
Yeah.
From there, things just slowly progressed. And a few months later, I was in New York, and then, I don't know, man, it's just really odd. It's just odd to be here doing an interview with NPR. The whole thing's very weird, but I'm happy about it.
Let's talk a little bit about how you got here, though. So I read that you started playing piano at age 4.
Yes, that's right.
Classically trained until you were 15.
Yes.
Studied at the famed Booker T. Washington School of the Performing Arts in Dallas.
That's
where
right.
Erykah Badu also went to school there.
Yes.
What was the point where you decided to start posting videos? And actually, it's a very specific type of engagement with the audience, because oftentimes you are listening to what they want from you and then responding by just on the fly putting together a piece of music.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of the, I guess, my selling point, if you want to call it that, the thing that makes my concerts something that hopefully people want to come back to, and the live streams that I do, is everything is made up from scratch, just off the top of the head. And the way I do that online is I take callers. I have a number up on the screen that people can call. I have conversations with strangers, and then they provide me with a topic to make a song about.
Yeah.
And then I make a song about that. Sometimes it sucks. Sometimes it's not so bad. But generally, there's always food there to eat musically.
food to eat musically.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I do that right now? Can I give you a topic and then just start talking? Well, you know, we're down to two people in the primary election.
Oh, man.
We've got two guys, Senator Bernie Sanders Vice President Joe Biden.
Joseph Biden.
Yes.
Yeah.
There were all of these people, and now they're just two.
Oh, my God. It happened fast, didn't it?
It did.
All right. We want to do something about that?
Let's do it.
One and two. One and two. We've got two choices. Ba-poop-a. Bernie Biden. 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 Got to make a decision, baby. How? Got to make a choice. I think it's pretty simple. Just vote for Bernie, baby. You gotta come on, baby. Vote for Bernie right now. We need your help. Or Biden is another choice. But yo, is Bernie in this thing? Yo, is Bernie all the way? Feel the burn 2020 in this thing. L.A. Hey, I'm coming up with political stuff. I don't know what I'm talking about, and that's the funny part. I'm just saying names and choosing a person. Yo, is Bernie Sanders? Is Bernie ever gonna make a choice?
And you said you weren't political.
I mean, I'm political in the most basic sense. In the most,
you know what is so fascinating about you is that obviously you're a talented musician. I mean,
thank you.
But you also embrace the absurd.
Oh, for sure. For sure. That is the show. That is the show 100%. It always has been. I hope it always is to a degree because, I don't know, I think there are a lot of musicians who are very gifted and who can take themselves and their art very seriously. I've never thought of myself that way. I take the music seriously. It should sound good, at least, but the message, I don't know. It should always be either very happy or very silly and ridiculous.
Yeah.
For me.
So there are those silly things, but some of your songs, like Twitter Page, which is one of my favorite, they're actually really insightful. It's sort of like social commentary.
Mm. I've never thought about it that way, but maybe it is.
Well, in particular, Twitter Page, you know, the song ends in a certain way, but it really starts with, like, we have these images of ourselves. We have what we present to society. Yeah. Here's my Twitter page. Here's what I have on my Twitter page.
Right.
You feel like you know that person. Maybe you're attracted to that person. Your song kind of illustrates this.
For sure. Yeah.
Can you do a little bit of Twitter page?
Oh, yeah. We can try and make it up.
Right. Let's see.
I like your Twitter page. Got some nice stuff on your Twitter page. It's looking good on your Twitter page. Lots of writing on your Twitter page. I saw your tweet last night. Love the way it looks on your Twitter page. I saw your tweet this afternoon. Love the way it looks on your Twitter page. I'm really interested in what you have to say.
That was about it, I think. So.
That was just about it. That was just about it. What's with the outfits that you wear? Oftentimes, you have your robe on.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have, there was one video where you actually had a police badge on.
Yeah.
Along with a t-shirt.
Oh, boy. Well, recently, there have been a lot of robes. And that came about just as a result of me touring and making a couple videos in robes. I like wearing robes when I'm home. It's just comfortable. People have turned that into a little baby meme on the internet. And then slowly but surely over the next couple tours, people started coming to the shows in robes.
Really?
Yeah. So, and now it's become this sort of like cabaret burlesque thing where at some point in the show, the robe is coming off. And, you know, I'm half the show is done in my underwear.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it is. It probably won't be that way forever. But that's the way it is right now. I'm thinking maybe on the next tour I'll wear like really well-tailored suits.
Ooh.
Might still take it off, but.
You have a couple of albums already, and they seem to be paying homage, at least on the surface, on the covers, to your father.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Tell us about him.
Well, he was an incredible human. He was Parisian, born in Paris, born and raised, about as thick a French accent as you can imagine. Very charismatic, huge energy, big flirt. Married to my mom for 48 years before he passed. And his passing sort of coincided with me starting to do this music thing professionally. He had always told me for years and years that I need to be the one on stage. I need to be the one singing. I need to get out there and do it, push it, keep going. I always resented him for that when I was younger because I just wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to do that.
Mm.
But as he slipped sort of into dementia, which is what he passed from, I found myself becoming attracted to that. The saddest thing is that he never got to see any of this.
Yeah. What year did he die?
He died at the end of 2018. And he just would have loved this,
yeah.
You know, and I miss him a lot.
This is sort of a big question, but it really brings it back to what you brought for me and my friend sending me a video of yours, is that you just kind of bring about this levity and joy, but there's also a talent there and there's mm-hmm. a depth there, even if it's just coming off the cuff for you.
Yeah.
Have you heard that from other folks, and is that why you do it?
I hear from a lot of people that what I'm doing with this is brings them something valuable, like brings them like a joy or comfort
yeah.
in times of depression and crisis. And I'm sort of a comfort in that way. And that is just incredible to me. Not something I ever anticipated being a part of this show, but it is. And that has informed the music that I'm making now. I find myself making music on positivity and encouragement, like big, big, happy love stuff. You got this. I believe in you. You can do this. You know, like, it's something. It's really something.
It's the power of music.
I suppose it is. Yeah.
That's Mark Rubier, electronic musician and YouTuber. This is such a pleasure. Can we jam out some more?
Oh, yeah. You want to do a jam?
Yeah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You better never give up on your dreams. You better never give up on your dreams. Never give up, baby. Never give up. Gotta never give up.
Parts of Tennessee are still cleaning up after tornadoes struck last week, leaving at least 24 dead and scores of homes and businesses destroyed. North Nashville was one of the hardest hit neighborhoods, and residents of the predominantly black neighborhood say they want to make sure that as it is rebuilt, the culture of their community survives. Damon Mitchell of member station WPLN reports.
24-year-old Cornelius Williams is walking down a congested road carrying a large grocery bag.
I'm about to go fire up the grill. Yeah.
He's hoping to make the best of the situation after Nashville's shocking tornado.
I mean, in my lifetime, I ain't never seen it like this in Nashville. Like, we get tornadoes, but they usually never hit, like, the middle city, you know what I mean?
Williams grew up in the area, and he's still trying to figure out a way to process the damage to his neighborhood.
I think it might bring people together some, though. Because, you know, disasters and everybody just kind of helping out and wanting things to be back kind of to the norm.
Immediately after the storm, there was a sense of panic. Dozens of residents filled the streets. By the next day, they were joined by hundreds of volunteers. Some cut trees and cleared debris from collapsed homes. Others watched from the comfort of their porches.
It's like you see it on TV, but then it hits you.
Faith Mitchell is a lifelong Nashvilleian. She grew up on the west side of town and moved to North Nashville 6 years ago. She's disabled, but used to be a childcare provider. The grandmother of 12 is distraught after tree branches punctured holes in her back bedroom. And she's been thinking about the moment she saw her half-clothed neighbors coming out of their homes after the tornado passed. On Friday, President Trump toured some of the devastated communities in Middle Tennessee, but didn't get to North Nashville. Nashville Mayor John Cooper did tour the neighborhood, but Mitchell says residents here still need more help.
Where is the people that we voted in? Where are y'all? That's the only thing I'm asking.
Mitchell's concern is echoed by her neighbors. They say the community is usually only talked about when there is a shooting or homicide. And there's another concern. Residents like Anton Nesbitt say the disaster could change the landscape of the neighborhood.
This is an opportunity for poor people to get pushed out. After they help clean the yards and cut the trees, then they're going to buy them out.
Nesbitt is a musician. He lives on a busy road with his wife and two children.
I think in the next 10 years, maybe five, it's going to look totally different.
His theory isn't far-fetched. There's a history of gentrification in Nashville after disasters. In the late 1990s, a tornado ripped through East Nashville. That sparked the wave of gentrification that brought nice restaurants and shops to the area, while also rising housing costs. Then the area's black population started to fall.
If you look throughout history, New Orleans and all the major natural disasters, it's been an opportunity for new development.
Just hours after the tornado, residents say the streets were filled with unfamiliar faces, snapping photos of the wreckage from SUVs and pickup trucks. Some residents fear there were developers here to target elderly neighbors and cash-strapped homeowners who didn't have storm insurance.
Then you got some who's just walking and looking and taking pictures, and you don't know what they might be going to do.
In the midst of recovery, protecting what's left of North Nashville has become a top priority for its residents. Many say the future here is uncertain, but they're determined to preserve the culture of their community. For Here and Now, I'm Damian Mitchell in Nashville.
The coronavirus is not the first major outbreak or pandemic the world has ever seen. They've happened before and they've changed history. Frank Snowden is professor emeritus of history and history of medicine at Yale University and has written a book called Epidemics and Society from the Black Death to the Present. He joins us now. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Well, let's start where you do with the Black Death, the bubonic plague, which became the standard against which later epidemics and pandemics would be measured. It's the worst ever. It was in the 14th century. It killed a third of the world's population. Where did it come from and how did it get so bad?
Oh, it came from reservoirs of animals in the Orient, particularly in China, and came by trade routes carried by fleas and rats who moved their way across the Mediterranean, and it had a devastating impact on every aspect of society, the arts, religion, the economy. It promoted the power of the modern state because communities had to organize to prevent this disease, and that took an enormous centralizing authority, which even needed an army administrative personnel. It needed civil authorities, boards of health. This took enormous resources, and therefore it's not by chance that the plague centuries are marked by the emerging power of the modern state, and the plague, in fact, is one of the factors that helps that process along.
Well, and it also gave us what we now know of as quarantine, right, in Venice.
That's right. Absolutely. Venice devised a protective device to ward off arrival from the east by using quarantine. That is, they decided to put all ships that were landing, to put them into a fortress-like place where the crews and their cargoes and passengers were kept for 40 days on the idea that after that they would be safe. They didn't understand what the incubation for plague would be. They guessed 40 days for religious purposes, and that turned out to be more than the incubation period. And so, in fact, it did protect Venice, and Venice ceased to be ravaged by the end of the 17th century. So these were measures that had effective means of protection against the bubonic plague and were indebted for the ideas of contagion and quarantine, isolation, and social distancing that we see playing out in front of our eyes today.
I have to say, before we go on, because we're going to get to some of the other pandemics in world history, but the idea of this coming from China to Italy and then ships being kept at sea and people being kept in quarantine for a certain period of time, it does sound awfully familiar to what we're seeing right now.
It absolutely does. It's eerie, the familiarity. And indeed, there are lots of people who are debating whether the right thing to do with coronavirus is to go back to this Venetian experiment, quarantining whole communities, not just individuals. And that's a debate that's dividing the European community. And I suspect we'll see that in the United States as well.
In the early 20th century, there was a flu pandemic that forced bans on public gatherings, school cancellations. That was the Spanish flu, which ended up killing about 50 million people across the world. What happened there?
Well, in terms of the Spanish flu, of course, it's a misnomer. It wasn't really had nothing to do with Spain. It's just that Spain was neutral in World War I, and so its press was not censored. So it was Spain was the place where the news got out of exactly how bad it was. There's a big debate now about how it began. Clearly, it was carried by birds, so this has a familiarity as well for our own times, and there was an overspill from the birds to human beings. But interestingly, though its mortality was huge, its impact was not the same as the Black Death, and indeed, it's often known as the forgotten pandemic. In fact, we just had the American president talk about, it's like influenza coronavirus, and influenza is nothing, he said, that kind of thing. So this is, I think, gives us an idea of how it's not simply the body count that tells us how important a disease really is. And there are other diseases like cholera that had a limited body count, but a huge impact on civilization. It's always very different because of these other factors.
Now, some people who have been looking at what we're dealing with now, the novel coronavirus, compare it to the swine flu of 2009, which did kill more than 500,000 people around the world. Is that a good comparison, do you think, at this point?
It would be a very brave person to make a prediction of what the end result of the coronavirus is going to be. It certainly has the potential to be a major international global disaster because it's transmitted relatively easily and it travels fast, but we don't know, and it's still to be played out, how effectively public health officials and countries will be in developing measures to contain and mitigate the disaster. So I don't want to take the pessimistic line of sounding the alarm and say, yes, this is going to be swine flu, or it's going to maybe even be worse. I just want to say we don't know yet, but it clearly has the possibility of something really dreadful. And one can easily, all too easily, imagine this being worse than swine flu.
We also have to talk about HIV/AIDS. Millions still live with it, but it has killed more than 30 million people worldwide since it was first documented in the early 1980s. And like the coronavirus, there is a period of time when people can transmit it but might not know that they have it. That makes it a lot harder to control, doesn't it?
Oh, yes. This is one of the huge factors that's really important. That is to say, modern public health depends on monitoring the population, knowing who's being affected, and then being able to move to isolate those people, identify their contacts, quarantine them. And those measures become very, very difficult if you don't have an easy and rapid diagnostic test. And coronavirus, happily, no one is sick for as long as people are contagious with HIV/AIDS. But nonetheless, that factor is really a major one that's propelling this disease forward. And we can see the U.S. government wasn't able to provide the various states in America with adequate numbers of diagnostic testing kits. And that's one of the reasons reasons, this lack of preparedness that is propelling the disease. In other words, it's been transmitting silently now for some weeks, and no one knew that it was actually already there. So this is a very dangerous part of the coronavirus.
Professor Snowden, countries around the world are responding to this disease in different ways. But let's just talk about the U.S. for a minute. With all of your background and your knowledge of these various pandemics that have happened over the course of human history, what would your one piece of advice be to the United States in how it handles this now?
I would say that the number one thing is the feature Bruce Aylward brought back from his experience of looking at coronavirus in China. He said what we need to do, first of all, is to change our mindset. In other words, we have to recognize that this is something we're all in. Otherwise, there'll be no possibility of containing it. So I think the first thing that makes all of the other measures possible is accepting reality. This is something that is real and important, and we can do something about it if we accept the science of it and mobilize and share our resources and not think that we can block it by false measures like bans and national barriers and all the rest of it, because coronavirus does not respect national borders or wealth or any of those things that we like to tell ourselves are bulwarks of protection.
That is Frank Snowden, whose book is called Epidemics in Society from the Black Death to the Present. He is a professor emeritus at Yale. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
Hundreds of thousands of women in Mexico are participating today in a nationwide strike called A Day Without Women. This comes after demonstrations and marches over the weekend to commemorate International Women's Day. In Mexico, violence against women was the focus. The government reports on average 10 women are killed each day, and thousands of others suffer verbal and physical violence. We have two reports from KJZZ's Fronteras desk. First, we go to Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
More than 80,000 people rallied in Mexico City yesterday. They included families with children, couples, moderate and radical feminists, but most of them women deeply concerned about violence against women. The women chanted, "Not one more woman murdered." The recent killings of a 7-year-old girl and a 25-year-old woman sparked their rallies all over the country, demanding justice and the end of femicides, which increased 10% from 2018 to 2019. But President Andrés Manuel López Obrador's reaction has been to blame the media and his conservative foes for inciting the protests.
No, hemos sido segregadas, maltratadas.
Maru Vasquez, a painter participating in the rally, says she doesn't want to talk about politics. She says violence against women has been around for many administrations, but it's time to stop being ignored.
No, lo que es lamentable es la reacción, no, que es la no reacción.
She says it's unfortunate that the administration hasn't reacted to women's concerns.
Yo creo que esto es una problemática de todo el mundo, no es especial de un país.
Vasquez believes this is a problem throughout the world, but it's time to build a new society based on respect. Protesters danced and sang as a street duet plays the protest anthem, Bella Ciao. But others threw graffiti on the streets and burned and destroyed police barricades. An unidentified group threw Molotov bombs near the gates of Mexico's presidential office, the National Palace, where police stood up using their shields to protect themselves. No violence, cried some of the protesters.
No violencia! No violencia!
Another woman, Beatriz Arevalos, says she's there to share the pain of one of her cousins, whose daughter was raped.
Porque comparto el dolor de una de mis primas. Hace un tiempo violaron a su hija.
Arevalos says she's also been a victim of sexual harassment. The perpetrator was not reprimanded. But she believes the rally will bring awareness against machismo in Mexico.
Soy una mujer tan valiosa y tan hermosa, y no soy un objeto sexual de nadie.
Arevalo said she's a beautiful and valuable woman, not a sex object. It is time, she said, for all Mexican women to feel the same. For Here and Now, I am Rodrigo Cervantes in Mexico City.
And I'm Kendall Blust, reporting from Hermosillo, the capital of the Mexican border state Sonora. Like their counterparts across Mexico, women here marched Sunday to demand justice. The number of women murdered in Sonora last year rose 80% to 117. Among the victims, young girls, university students, and a beloved scholar and activist who was brutally murdered by a romantic partner.
No creo que importe mucho la edad o cómo es físicamente, simplemente con ser mujer.
19-year-old Mila Lopez says all women are at risk of violence in Mexico. Decked out from head to toe in purple, the color of the movement, she was among thousands of women gathered Sunday to march more than a mile through rain-soaked streets to the Central Plaza. They arrived at sunset under a glowing purple sky to proclaim their reasons for taking to the streets.
Nos siguen hostigando, nos siguen violando.
To honor those who have been killed. And to celebrate their unity. But they were also angry and fed up. And when the lights went out in the plaza, it felt to many like an intentional provocation. Just 2 weeks earlier, women in Hermosillo tore down the gates of the judiciary building after being left in the dark during another protest. This time, they stormed the cathedral, breaking windows, graffitiing the side of the building, and shouting, "Pedophiles and don't touch little boys." Inside, worshippers barricaded the doors with church pews.
El estrés, el hartazgo, el de la desesperación.
Chelsea Montaño says stress and desperation have pushed women to their limit. And her friend Barbara Rodriguez added that while they want to protest peacefully, if change means burning everything to the ground, that's what they'll do.
Que se quiebre lo que se tenga que quebrar y se queme lo que se tenga que quemar.
It might not be an easy fight, she says, but it's worth it to create a better future for women and girls in Sonora and across the country. Today, their protests continue with a nationwide strike called A Day Without Women. For Here and Now, I'm Kendall Blust in Hermosillo, Sonora.
And yesterday's protests around the world calling for women's equality were tense. In Turkey, police reportedly fired tear gas on groups of protesters. Police in Santiago, Chile, say more than 125,000 people gathered. And after some protesters threw rocks at police, authorities responded by using a water cannon to control the crowds. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. As the coronavirus spreads in the U.S., costs are mounting. One estimate puts the cost of testing alone at $25 million in the first 2 months of the outbreak. Then there's the price tag of patients with severe cases who could be in the hospital for weeks. So who's paying for it all? That's next time on Here and Now.